Welcome to the Reaction podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction. I'm joined by Maggie Pagano, my esteemed colleague, executive editor of Reaction. We can't really begin this talking about the weather, but the weather is really, really weird. So if at some point your Wi-Fi seems to be suffering with the weather, so does mine. So if at some point there are glitches, apologies for that. You like this crazy weather?
I love this stormy weather. Yeah, it means you can sort of hide inside and light fires, and you know you don't have to go out and dig the garden. It's quite nice sometimes.
Yes, the Scandi thing. Yeah, exactly. So we're going to talk a bit about BBC and Royals and Harry. We're going to talk about Boris a bit, and what I'm going to be writing my weekly newsletter on straight after this podcast. And we're going to talk about lots of good news on vaccines and all that sort of stuff. But can I just start on the BBC stuff, Maggie? And some people will say it's a bit of a cheek for journalists in general to be so down on the BBC, but you're considering all sorts of other scandals that have been in relation to journalism, but you think they have completely screwed up and the heads must roll and all that sort of stuff, though Tony Hall is no longer at the BBC.
Yes, I do, Ian, and I'm not taking the, you know, defund the BBC, don't pay your licence. That's not really what I think is important here. What we've seen is that somebody knowingly faked bank statements to trap somebody into an interview, and that is a crime. And then the BBC and the boss at the time covered it up. And I think that we need to see accountability. Now, whether the police are going to prosecute Martin Bashir, I don't know. But certainly Tony Hall, I think, needs to show that what they did was wrong. There's no point apologising. It's too late. But he has to actually just show it by taking steps. And there's been some talk already this morning that, you know, he should be stripped of his CBE, that he should step down from the National Gallery. Well, I think he should do those things voluntarily. He should show that, show not tell. I think quite a separate argument, you know, defund the BBC. It's accountability, show they got it wrong. I mean, I was thinking actually earlier on, why did the BBC even do this interview? Was it really public interest? I'm staggered that Diana agreed to it. And I don't know if you've seen Ian Hislop's response to this, which is that, you know, she would have done it anyway and it doesn't really matter. And I think that's a really tenuous, weak, and actually quite a dangerous argument.
But also by former boss Andrew Neil, writing in the Mail on Friday, made a really good point, which is that the lies that Bashir told, I mean, it's not just the bank statements thing, it's the stuff he told her to convince her that he knew definitively that she was being tracked and followed and every phone call was being recorded, that it added, as Prince William put it, to her paranoia, it seems pretty clear was a factor in her not ending up with royal security and wanting to be as far away from the royal apparatus in every respect as possible. And if she had still, as she should have done, had a proper protection duty team with her in Paris in 1997, they wouldn't have let her get in the car with, with the driver, as happened, and she is perfectly credit, perfectly fair to say that she wouldn't have died. So there is, it's very interesting the way he just traces that thread right from the ripple effect that the lie has. There's also the question of the cover up at the BBC, and there are various old Panorama hands pointing out that various reporters who tried to raise questions about Bashir's conduct were fired or manoeuvred out of Panorama. I mean, I think you asked Maggie why they did it. If you think back, it was a massive story. I mean, I remember sitting down and watching it as a household and it had an enormous, I can't remember how big the audience was, but it had a huge audience.
Yeah, it was a sort of,
and this incredible.
It was a JFK Kennedy moment, wasn't it? Where were you on that interview? It was shocking. Yeah, no, and it's disastrous. But I think the point that Andrew Neil made was such a good one. There is a direct line, and it is the feeding of the paranoia. And he also made the point that when some of those questions were asked about Bashir and his tactics, you know, it could have been that if they hadn't have covered up, that would have come out a couple of months later. And, you know, Diana would have understood that this was a great lie, and who knows what then would not have happened. No, it's tragic. And heads should roll. I don't say that easily, but yeah. I really think in this case, I can't even imagine what the two princes feel about it. It must be horrendous. Well, we know what...
You mentioned the defund the BBC. Yeah. You mentioned the defund the BBC stuff that's running, and there's a potentially very significant change coming in British media, isn't there, with the launch of GB News coming in the next few weeks and months, and announcing all their new presenters and lineups and shows and that sort of stuff. So it does come at a really difficult moment for the BBC in terms of its reputation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really exciting. I mean, what's exactly what BBC needs, isn't it? Good competition, make them rethink how they cover a lot of things. It's been very interesting. I'm sure, like you, follow on Twitter all the JP News and all the new, you know, reporters from Yorkshire, from Wales, from the making a real point of seeking people out from the provinces who have good knowledge. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they cover that, whether they keep them there locally and how they, you know, do try to say, you know, the non-London focus. It's going to be, yeah. Although a lot of the teams do look as though they're sort of,
they're not strictly
kind of dancing.
I can though hear, as if there are any friends from the BBC listening to this who are appalled at us, appalled at you saying that, as though GB News is doing something unusual, hiring people from the from other parts of Britain, and that, you know, of course the BBC has an enormous, you know, news operation in all sorts of parts of the country and a big, you know, network of reporters and presenters from non-London. But they do seem to be, well, they're very obviously attempting to capture that sense of the Beeb coming from a very particular worldview. And I think, I mean, I was initially, you know, quite not sceptical, but it's a really tough thing to do, incredibly tough thing to do, to launch a new TV channel. It's very resource intensive, but they seem to have they think they've identified an audience there that wants something different. And as you said, it's all competition. On the question of, you mentioned Harry just before we pressed record on this, you were explaining how you just felt it was so sad because he's popped up again. I mean, it's like, you know, Every week there's a podcast or a TV program with someone like Apple or Netflix appearing in which he's bearing his soul, and he's also in the middle of one of these moments where I can't remember which historian it was who said every 60 years or so America goes mad, and it does. It's just having one of those historic meltdowns, and he's in the middle of it. I think fair to say, not an intellectual, and part of the entertainment, become captured by the entertainment complex and celebrity complex, and is just emoting on demand for hungry audience, which then gets clicks and sells advertising on the back of it, while denouncing the media.
I know. I mean,
it would be hilarious if it wasn't so
ironic.
Sad.
I mean, the only thing that one can hope is that, you know, he gets it all out, and that, you know, you can't keep going saying this for months on end, can you? I mean, I don't know. The Americans, as you say, potentially they can. But it seems to me, I think somebody remarked earlier this week, that he's had too much therapy. And you do wonder if he had sort of married somebody who was quite happy to go and live in the country, and he could have gone chopped down trees and hunted and had a quiet life, you might not be much happier. I don't know. I'm sure there are a lot of mental health people who are going to start screaming at that. But if it helps him to get it all out, if he needs to say this, I think then that doesn't, if it helps him, then that's great. The question is, to what extent does it damage the monarchy? You know, the constant references to Prince Charles making him suffer as a child. I mean, we sort of do know that they do live a very strange life. I suspect that the monarchy is much, much tougher and it will survive, and that Harry, this will be a blip. And in a couple of months' time, you know, he'll have to go off on safari or something to film something new, because people will be bored. Don't you think?
But is this a route to... Yeah, possibly. But is this a route to... Is this conceivably a route to happiness? That doesn't strike me as plausible. I know there's always this condemnation of the royal family being, you know, having the stiff upper lip, and it's actually much more complex than that. Or if you consider how amusing someone like the Queen Mother was, and how, you know, gossipy that class and that family can be. So it's not the one dimensional thing that they're suppressing their pain all the time and being endlessly cruel, though it's a tough gig in certain respects. But I think this Californian myth, which, as I say, is amplified because it is commercially hugely successful. But the idea that just spilling your guts emotionally nonstop somehow gets you almost religious style to a moment of peace or calm or grace is, I just think, mad. I mean, isn't there something in a more traditional approach which accepts, well, you know, maybe he needs a philosopher to go and talk to him rather than a therapist to point out that life is full of pain.
Absolutely.
It's part of the condition. It's human existence, and you try and minimize it, avoid it, work around it, learn lessons from it. But it's the idea that you can just get it all out and the pain somehow disappears and you have that moment. You have that moment of perfect grace is nuts. Or am I being too harsh?
I think you're absolutely right. I could be even more cruel. Clearly, he thinks he needs to do it. And so maybe if he thinks that, but it's, you know, as the great Catholic philosophy is that you have to suffer to enjoy the good parts in life. And he's got to sort of realize that, yeah, as you say, life is very tough. He's a bit spoiled though, isn't he? Come on, let's admit it. And sadly, the lifestyle that he's found himself in California draws on the very, very worst of those vulnerabilities. Hey ho. Let's talk about something more positive.
Yeah.
Let's talk about.
Right. So that's enough. Yeah. That's enough royals and American psychobabble and all that sort of stuff. What are we going to talk about next?
We talk about Boris's new, this launch of the vaccine. It's part of the COVAX thing with the Europeans next week that you were telling me about. And then we got our lead.
Yes. Well, that's good. Yes, that's good. Yeah, that's all good. That's all good news, isn't it? Yeah, so we're right with the leader on reaction this week on Saturday morning is about, you know, veers for vaccine victory and just celebrating some of the stuff that's going on. And the government has simultaneously announced this new sort of pandemic awareness thing using Britain's extraordinary genomic testing capacity, you know, conducting nearly half of the sort of mapping that's going on in the world at the moment. So yeah, so that's what the leader is about, and celebrating reopening. And I have to say, the reaction news team had their first team meeting involving drinks, and it was just, and we, you know, as you pointed out, Maggie, we've been working together as a team, and some of the newer members of our team not actually met each other. I mean, living this Zoom existence, and there were a couple of our team who I hadn't met who joined in the last, since last lockdown. So I had drinks last night, and it was it was just joyful, just life returning. And London looked fantastic. Still very quiet. I mean, difficult getting bookings because of the restrictions. And but still, you know, lots of particularly young people, not me, out and about, and tentatively just this sense of liberation coming. And I think it's going to be a spectacular summer. Some concerns, I think, about the winter, just about weather. We were talking about it last night at our reaction team meeting. Just it's a summer like no other to be really relished and enjoyed. London and a lot of major cities are going to be quite empty of tourists, but buzzing with people wanting to spend money and enjoy themselves and see friends and just enjoy that. And then, but I do think that the winter is going to be tough with a potentially quite difficult flu season. Anyway, I wanted to talk about good news. So the good news is the vaccines are working, and we learned this week. Well, what did we learn on Indian variants?
Well, that the vaccine is, all the vaccines are protective of just about every variant is what they're now hoping for. And also the signs are that in those little hotspots, Bolton and Blackburn, that actually the numbers are really low. I think there are 20 people in hospital in Bolton now. And of course, we've had the lowest number of deaths recorded in the last 5 years. So it's looking good. It's also looking very good in Europe. You saw the French opened up this week. The cafes are open, still with social restrictions, mm-hmm. and so are the museums and so forth. And the vaccination program there is really speeding up. They reckon about 70%. So that is really good news. Whether people should start traveling again on holiday is a moot point, even though the EU have said that people can travel without quarantine, isn't it, between countries? We're not quite there yet, are we? What do you think? Do you think that should have said?
Yeah, there is.
Do we think they should have just said, honestly, don't travel this summer if you can?
Well, of course, the government has tried to do that, or rather part of the government has tried to do that. So you had earlier this week the mix-up with some government ministers indicating that travel, you know, that travel should happen, or that, you know, the reopening, the international reopening is a good thing. And then Lord Bethell, the health minister in the Lords, took a very different position, and essentially said, "Don't travel unless it's completely essential, or just don't travel, stay at home." So there's a tussle going on in inside government on this. Personally, I'm for reopening and for really enjoying the summer. And lots of my friends are desperate to get to France. I'd love to get to France, Italy, Spain, Sweden. But my instinct is this is a year, considering the winter that we've all been through. The potential for next winter to just be, I don't think anything. Fingers crossed, nothing like the last winter, and let's hope to God that's not the case. But just tricky with people on alert for flu outbreaks and for changes in variants, and people having to get jabbed with boosters and all that sort of stuff. I just think I take sort of caution first view, which I know will annoy some of my friends who, as I say, have already booked their ferry tickets. I can think of quite a few reaction subscribers I know who are just raring to go, and I get the instinct. I want to be sitting in the, you know, I want to be sitting in the in Gigondas in my favourite restaurant, sipping a glass of a Provençal rosé and all the rest. But I just, for me, that feels as though, unless things surprise on the upside, and the French are really desperate to get the Brits back spending money, unless there's surprising the upside, I'm doing Scotland all the way, I think, for this summer. Yeah,
we're sticking to Norfolk as well, and then Scotland in the autumn. It just seems to me also that actually it won't be a very pleasant experience going through airports. Are really, you know, become such a trauma, really. But going through with masks and sitting on an airplane, I just think, hey, skip it this year. Let's put our money into the British economy instead.
I also want to get back to, I want to get back to train travel on the continent, which we love doing. And there's a great story this week and a good, really good leader in the Times as well, hailing the return of the night trains, which I've always liked, traveling overnight. And there were so few of them until recently. And it is an upside of the French government's drive on climate stuff and emissions, is that there are 10 more services opening, and Paris to Nice overnight is coming back. So I want to go and want to do that, but I don't want to do it in a mask. Don't want a mask and all the hassle, and you just want to rock up at St. Pancras, change in Paris, and go somewhere brilliant on the continent and enjoy it, rather than, as you say, worrying about testing and all that sort of.
I was just going to say, Ian, I read some. I adore trains myself. Would always go by train if I can over airplane, and the night trains. It's just so sort of romantic. But somebody was pointing out this morning that Berlin to Vienna is 9 hours, so we've still got a far to go before they can speed up some of those European connections. Seems like an awful long time. When we need to bring back Interrail.
I don't mind that, but. So we were also going to talk about Boris and politics a little bit, weren't we? Because I'm just settling down to write my Reaction newsletter for subscribers. And if you're not a subscriber to Reaction and you want to get all of our brilliant columnists, including Maggie and Tim Marshall on geopolitics, and a list of brilliant, brilliant writers every week, become a subscriber. And also we've got our live events coming back. That's the other good news. Neil Ferguson is in conversation with me at the Garrick Theatre on the 6th of July. And the details are on the site. So, yes, I'm just sitting down to write it straight after this. I'm going to write about, we're speaking earlier about state of perfect grace and the position that Boris Johnson finds himself in now. With he's polling about 45%. He's smashing Starmer, who's reduced to trying to get noticed by going on Piers Morgan's Life Story Stories program and trying to relaunch. So Boris is dominant. And I was just struck by the symmetry of the dates, which it will be 2 years ago next week that the European elections happened under Theresa May. And you look at the numbers there, the Tories now on mid-40s, polled, I think, 8.8%. And that's just 2 years ago. It feels like a different world in which that happened. And, of course, the Brexit Party now effectively non-existent and disappeared, and Tories have just swallowed that vote. And the Brexit Party was on, I think, more than 30% of the vote and won that European election. And in 2 years... there's been a change of prime minister, Corbyn getting flattened, big Tory majority, pandemic. And then now Boris is dominant, triumphant. And what I'm going to write about is, what do those who don't like this do about it? Because this seems to be, unless something goes very badly wrong for the Tories, this is a state that's going to exist for some time. A, the country needs an opposition, because it's very unhealthy when there's a situation in which government has too much power. Governments become arrogant and make even more mistakes. And secondly, you just need that spirit of competition and for people to believe that it is possible to change the government. So I'm going to explore how that might happen. But the problem that the Labour Party, well, there are many problems the Labour Party have that I'll explain what I think is going on. But the positions are almost reversed in Scotland and England, mirrored rather, where there are two incumbents, both dominant with almost 50% of the vote, and then their opponents split and divided. And in those circumstances, the incumbent party wins. Yeah. And Labour's now got the Greens on its tail in certain parts of England. pockets of Lib Dem revival as well. And notoriously, you know, we know what's happening in the Red Wall with traditional Labour voters going Tory. And you were saying earlier, Maggie, you just thought, well, if there is an answer to this, it doesn't seem to be Keir Starmer. No,
it's not. And it's going to be very interesting. I can't remember who wrote it this week, but I mean, it's not Keir Starmer. And I don't say that because if I wanted to vote Labour, I just don't know what I'd be voting for. It's not clear at all. I don't get any sense of, we've talked about this before, Ian, but, you know, what would he do differently? If he became Prime Minister tomorrow, what would he do? There's no alternative. And the reason we don't have an opposition is because people don't have the ideas. I don't see any. In fact, most of the ideas are on the right. And what I was going to say to you, saying that we've got a government that has been in power for 10 years, but actually the Tories provide their own opposition. And they are, at the moment, the sort of David Davis, Steve Baker, the Freedom People, Mark Harper. Actually, there's more internal debate within the Tories. And then you've got the One Nation crowd. You've got the more free marketeers. You've seen it over Liz Truss on trade, free traders. That's where all the debate is. Labour just don't, you know, we're not hearing it. I don't think we're hearing it because they're not having it. Or they're so stuck still in, you know, on work, some really interesting, you know, the sort of technological determinism of work. The reason they can't talk about the working class is they're obsessed with the idea that work will disappear. Well, you know, then you can't have any decent policies on how you're going to attract the working class. So I think it's nuanced, as always. But the question is, do they get rid of Keir? And I guess the king over the water at the moment is Andy Burnham. He's committed to being mayor for 5 years. Is it 5 years? 4 years? 4 years. So if you waited for 2024, they've got time to bring him back and he could stand as an MP. Or does Boris go very quickly in 2023 before heir apparent? I mean, we're assuming lots of things, but it's going to be very interesting to see whether Labour want to, whether they do have another coup.
Well, interestingly, an MP was telling me this week, was explaining to me why he is convinced that there won't be an early election. And it does make quite a lot of sense. It's because of the boundary review. I can't remember the precise dates, but I think you don't get the full boundary review. You don't know exactly where you are in terms of shape of constituencies, which then makes it difficult in terms of choosing candidates because people don't know quite where they're going to stand. And I think that really only comes to a head in early summer 2023. So there'd be a possibility of an autumn election. I think the Tories will go long. And also let's see what happens to the economy. I know what you mean on that. Just that point you made about future of work. You were referring to the kind of Paul Mason view of the world. Paul Mason, the author, former Newsnight, lefty author, who, you know, several years ago, you know, wrote some quite interesting stuff about this, about technology, and this is his theory, which people like Angela Rayner seem intrigued by. But as you say, this is where the kind of four day, 3 day, no day week stuff comes from. Just doesn't sound very practical. Certainly not practical in the current electoral cycle. On Burnham, I would question, and I love Liverpool, love visiting Liverpool, but I would just question. He said politely, the English appetite for a Liverpudlian Prime Minister. I'm not sure I can see England voting for Burnham. I mean, he's an interesting character. What he's done with Manchester, and he's building an alternative base. Clearly wants to go for it. Once you think beyond that, they don't have that many options, do they?
I mean, Yvette Cooper is
a fascinating politician now. And as someone was pointing out to me the other day, the routine with Ed Balls, who's transformed himself, as put it to me, in Portillo style Tory, said, look at how he's, you know, he's done Strictly Come Dancing, he's done the memoir, he's rehabilitated himself, and that Ed and Yvette could be quite a pairing with her as leader of the Labour Party. It's a compelling story. That's on interpretation. It's unclear whether she would do very well with the Labour Party membership. Yeah. Beyond that,
Rayner is not in with it. She hasn't got a 0.1% chance on any level. Stephen Kinnock, how about someone we haven't even thought of? He's quite sort of... Okay. 0.0. I can't think of any. I'm not sure Yvette has that sort of touch of the people about her. I mean, you would have to draw back, as well as the sort of urban young liberals, you've got to draw back the, I hate using the expression red wall, but, you know, those who work. I'm not sure. There's no one else, is there? Probably it's someone we haven't even thought of. Somebody who's only just become an MP.
But in those circumstances, then the Tories have a long time left in power, potentially. Questions, I wrote about it for the Times this week. What is the point of this government? What are they really trying to do? There's quite a lot of Tories, I think, wonder. Though Boris has a lot of fans. And someone pointed out to me, explaining to me, a Tory activist who got in touch after I'd written that, said, well, you know, you give him some credit in that he did see off, I mentioned that 2-year span since the European elections, but he did see off Corbyn. Mm-hmm. He did bulldoze through Brexit, which was the main point of getting Boris Johnson as leader of the Tory party, wasn't it? And then, you know, getting that majority of 80 seats, and he's taken the Tory party from 8-9% in the polls back to 45% and a winning coalition. So there are plenty of things to criticise him for, but he's a hell of a politician, it looks like. So I think we'll wrap things up there, won't we? And as I said, if you're not a Reaction subscriber, but you're listening to this and you enjoyed it, go to the website and become a Reaction subscriber. Join us for our event with Neil Ferguson at the Garrick Theatre. Tickets are on sale now. A real live event with a bar and no Zoom. Though we will, of course, record the event for subscribers and send it out a couple of days afterwards. Not everyone will want to get to London to join in with a real live event, but those of you who want to come, please do. And until next time, thank you very much.